Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
It's the very start of March 2024, and the air is full of misty rain, the kind which manages to be soft and light, but also gets you completely soaked through. I've taken shelter in a little village church. It's a gloomy day, and very little daylight is filtering through the leaded panes of the windows. I love stepping into these little pockets of silence. There's always an incredible hush after the symphony of the outdoors, the calls of birds, the sound of traffic skimming through floods on the road, the howl of the wind in the trees. But in here, it's quiet and very still. I love entering old churches, spaces which have seen centuries of people coming together as a community, but also standing alone to reflect and think. I always think of the idea of seeking sanctuary, the idea that dangers without can't touch us once we're inside. Today's story is all about those times when even places of great safety can be invaded by dark and dangerous forces, and how easily sanctuary can be corrupted. With that thought in mind, bolt your doors firmly against the howling rage of the devil outside them, then gather close around the fire and listen in. Welcome to the Three Ravens podcast.
There were three ravens sat on a tree. Down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, "Where shall we our breakfast take? With a down, derry, 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 down, down."
Hello and welcome to episode 39 of the Three Ravens podcast. I'm Eleanor Conlon, and I'm bursting through a church door, scratching it with my searing claws as lightning strikes its tower, and my co-host Martin Vaux is gazing on in horror.
The horror! The horror!
Oh, Eleanor, it's you.
It is me, yeah. And I'll shake off my hellhound, guys, so we can record the podcast.
Oh, thank you.
It's a bit difficult to look at my notes with these big black paws, actually. Now, we are in equal parts excited and rather sad that we have come to the end of our first lap around England's 39 historic counties.
Oh, what a journey it has been. We have learned so much and discovered so many fascinating stories, superstitions and local history on the way.
Of course, we've been in the company of our most excellent Three Ravens community. You have all been absolutely amazing, and it's been a total joy to connect with you and explore this strange and beautiful world together. Mm-hmm. We really could not do it without any of our wonderful listeners, not least our Patreon subscribers. And this week, we are welcoming Lizzie to the Conspiracy of Ravens.
All hail Lizzie, King of Patreon!
After this episode, we'll be taking a short break from mainline episodes. But never fear, Three Raven Things will still be happening. But we'll save the rundown of what's coming until our correspondence section at the end.
We will say, though, that we'll be hosting a special live stream chat on Patreon on Saturday the 9th of March at 7 p.m. So we hope that you'll be able to join us for a bit of a chinwag.
Just another quick reminder, too, that our folky flash fiction competition closes today, Monday the 4th of March. So if you're a last-minute raven desperately flapping to finish your story, please fly over and deposit them on our reading pile by midnight at the latest.
We are really looking forward to reading all of them. It's so exciting. And I'm just kind of blown away by the response we've had. It's been amazing.
Yes, it's been amazing. And I can't wait to get stuck in.
Mm-hmm.
So we're releasing this episode on Monday the 4th of March, almost exactly a year to the day we started Three Ravens in 2023.
And is the 4th of March worthy of our notice for any other reason than lighting the candles on the raven-shaped birthday cake and celebrating the fact that we got all the way around historic England?
Well, I love an obscure saint.
You do.
But even I have been a bit discombobulated by Saint Adrian, who is celebrated today. Or is he?
What do you mean, or is he?
Well, because the figure of Saint Adrian has been conflated or confused with a number of other saints.
Right.
Adrian may or may not have actually been a saint, but he was probably certainly a monk.
Probably certainly.
Who lived on the Isle of May and was brutally killed by Viking raiders in 875 and had a shrine created there for him. But Adrian may not have actually been the person the Vikings killed, who was more likely to have been another person called Ethanen, also a monk, possibly of May, or Iona.
This is confusing.
Anyway, a small cult grew up around the shrine of Ethanen or Adrian, and pilgrims visited it for its healing powers.
So hold on a minute. Were these the same person or weren't they? Because, you know, people did have several names sometimes.
Well, in medieval legends, they were recorded as two entirely separate saints, but they do have rather similar backstories.
Okay.
Ethanen's cult at least spread out to several other places in Scotland and even made it as far as Wales, actually. His name appears inscribed in Oham on various mystical stones throughout Scotland as well. And he also gained another nickname, Saint Ernie.
What?
Although scholars have speculated that this came about due to him being also conflated with Saint Irenaeus of Lyon.
Now, Eleanor, this is just getting a bit silly.
It is a bit silly,
isn't
it?
Unless any of these people did astounding miracles or died horrible deaths, or at least had some kind of suggestively shaped cake named after them, I don't think we should be celebrating them at all.
What?
These are valuable podcasting minutes we're losing.
That's a bit harsh. I'm going to say a happy Saints Day to Adrian, Ethanen, Ernie, and indeed Irenaeus. And I'd advise them to watch out for Viking raiders more closely next time.
Okay, well, if you say so. Is it time to get the county criers out of their raiding longboats to persuade them to ring us into Norfolk?
It certainly is. Good. Come on, you lot. Stop harrying those monks. Norfolk is located in the east of England in East Anglia. It's bordered by Lincolnshire to the northwest, the North Sea to the north and east, Suffolk to the south, and Cambridgeshire to the west. As ever, you can see its precise location on the map on our blog at threeravenspodcast.com, along with lots of pictures of places of note in Norfolk. Martin, do you have any associations with Norfolk?
Not a ton, although when I was a much younger chap, I think I must have been about 11 or so, I did go on a Cub Scout camp to Norfolk, where I got into loads and loads of trouble.
Oh, yes.
And ended up being kicked out of the Scouts. But I did have a really nice day of leading my group of fellow Scouts way off the marching path we were supposed to be on, and to Cromer, where we spent a lovely afternoon crabbing in the sea. My Cub Scout master didn't like the fact that we'd done that very much, but I had a lovely time.
Oh, well, I can't imagine why you were kicked out of the Scouts. That sounds very wholesome and in the spirit of scouting.
Well, I would have thought so. I mean, there was some other stuff about lighting fires I shouldn't have lit. Because, I mean, you know, Scouts,
the old unsanctioned fire.
They always say, yeah, you should learn how to light a fire, but they're very picky about where and when you do that.
I guess the line gets a bit blurry about when it's scouting and when it's, you know, arson.
Yes, that's right. And I didn't burn anyone or anything apart from wood in a hole that I dug, so I thought it was fine, but no. Wasn't the hole
on the high street of Promo?
No, it was out in the woods near the Cub Scout camp, but I should have apparently been doing other scouty things at the time. I don't know. It was all a bit tedious.
It sounds too difficult to keep up with, honestly.
I know, right? But we have in recent years, because we do like to go to Suffolk semi-frequently, dipped over the border into Norfolk a few times, and we had a lovely day out, didn't we, last year, visiting Norwich and having a good old wander around.
Yes, we certainly did. And I've visited Norfolk a number of times and had some wonderful experiences. A very profound moment for me was taking a very small boat from Blakeney Point through the salt marshes and seeing a huge colony of grey seals in the nature reserve.
Wow, that sounds amazing.
Oh, it was wonderful. All those beautiful selkies.
Yeah.
As I'm sure I've mentioned, I was born in East Anglia, and there is something about that part of the world that just speaks to me. I love it.
Yeah, you do. And we are really looking forward to a Norfolk trip this very summer, aren't we?
Yes, we will be off to Bungie's Black Shuck Festival in August, which we're very much looking forward to. It's a beautifully rural part of the world, with the largest settlements being Norwich, which is also the county town, and King's Lynn, Great Yarmouth and Thetford.
It's all quite magical round there, isn't it? I mean, the whole of East Anglia is quite a magical place in my opinion.
It certainly is. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of folklore to talk about, as well as folk magic and other marvellous tidbits.
Excellent.
A fun piece of trivia I found is that people from Norfolk were sometimes known as Norfolk dumplings.
What?
After the traditional local food.
Really?
Yep. I think calling someone a dumpling is actually quite cute.
Yeah, it is, but it's
nicer
suggests
than the Surrey capon.
Yeah, that's true. It suggests, though, that they are a bit rounder than the average person and probably made with quite a lot of fat. That has not been in my experience of people from Norfolk, really. They tended to be quite stringy.
No, I wonder where it comes from,
yeah,
really. It's certainly much cuter than referring to someone as normal for Norfolk.
Yes.
Which seems to have been a slightly insulting piece of medical slang intended to convey the idea of Norfolk people as a little bit strange and rustic. Possibly as a result of inbreeding.
Yes, possibly. But this is one of those, you know, national cliches, isn't it? That Norfolk is a place where people share quite a lot of the same base genetic matter for whatever reason.
Yes, and I don't know if there's actually any truth to that whatsoever.
No. Nope.
Possibly in the 15th century, but certainly not these days.
But, you know, there are these little pockets of bigotry all over this country, aren't there?
Absolutely. Norfolk actually also has a dialect called Broad Norfolk.
Yeah.
But it's nearly entirely died out. And it's actually more of an accent these days than a dialect and a sense of grammatical style rather than a full dialect.
We do love a dialect though, don't we? I mean, have you got some choice words from this dialect for me, Eleanor?
Well, at the end of the episode, we'll be able to bid everybody to keep your attrition, which means farewell or take care.
Great.
And if something really winds us up, we might say, that craze me.
Ooh, that craze me.
But I sincerely hope that none of our listeners think that we're talking a load of old squit, which needs no translation.
No, I can presume what that means.
Well, I'll try and keep my history brief, although I'm aware this is more easily said than done, especially when a place is as interesting as Norfolk. It has an incredibly rich prehistoric past. There's evidence of settlement as early as the Paleolithic period. So for context, that's 950,000 years ago.
Whoa.
When you basically couldn't move for hyenas and woolly mammoths.
Yeah, gotta say, I'm not wild on the idea of wall-to-wall hyenas, but you really like hyenas. I can't explain it.
Yeah, you're not fond of a hyena,
no.
But I find them quite appealing.
Well, I mean, because I grew up in East Africa a little bit. Did
yeah,
actually
I
spend
mean,
a bit more time around hyenas.
Met
than you.
A hyena.
Yeah,
I've studied
scary.
Them at a distance.
And their bite power is amongst the most strong bite power of any creature in nature. And that idea that they could just so easily break like an arm bone or a leg bone with a single hump, that scares me.
I admire that about them.
Yeah.
And they're also matriarchal creatures, which is really unusual. So, yeah, I think they're pretty interesting.
Still, 950,000 years. I mean, that is amongst the oldest sets of remains and, you know, bits of archaeology that we've encountered in all of England. And I'm imagining that's got to have something to do with the Doggerland and England being connected to mainland Europe.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, the hyenas certainly didn't prevent humans occupying Norfolk. And as you say, some of the earliest evidence of human life in Britain has been discovered there. And that's when the east of England was connected to mainland Europe.
Yes.
By the Doggerland Peninsula, as it is now become known, but it's, you know, it's in the sea, it's floated
it
off.
Yeah, there was a huge tidal wave that washed away this land bridge. If you've never learnt about the Doggerland, I seriously recommend having a Google. absolutely fascinating because people, in the first place, walked here, basically. They didn't have to sail.
Didn't have to sail. A really long time ago, that is.
Yeah. So how old are, for example, the first kind of human remains or evidence of humans that we have?
Probably dating from about 668,000 BC.
Blimey.
So we've got flint tools dating from them. And also one of the most important sites of Neanderthal man in England in the Thetford Forest.
Yes. Now, Eleanor, in general, I think it's fair to say, is not really that bothered about flint tools. Like whenever we go to museums, you're like, oh, some more axes.
I think you can have a bit too much of a good thing when it comes to flint tools. But even I can see that maybe a flint tool that old is pretty awe-inspiring.
Yes.
And there have been some really significant finds and excavations across Norfolk, including the discovery of Grimes Graves, as they're styled now. They were called Grimm's Graves in the Saxon period. They're a 400-pit group of Neolithic flint mines.
They are one of the most sensational and beautiful places. I mean, I've never been down into them. I know that under special conditions, people can go down into them, but in so many different documentaries, I've seen them venture down into those spaces. And these mines are kind of impossible to imagine unless you see them, really. But, you know, vertical pits heading down into the earth, dug by people with antlers who just scraped and scraped and scraped
and
away.
Flint tools, of course.
And flint tools. Well, but this is the thing, they were looking to excavate the flint, and they could have gone to other places to do it, but they chose to keep digging at Grimes Graves or Grimm's Graves, which seems to have been a holy site and place. And at the bottom of all of these pits, when they reached the end of a tunnel and decided we've dug enough here, they then just left the tools they were using almost like a sacrifice.
That's it. And they
were there for so long.
Exactly. So we've got these incredible finds because we've been able to see exactly the path they took through the pits to do this.
Insane and so, so interesting. So, I mean, I guess that means all the axe heads you could possibly ever want,
and
Eleanor.
Then some.
And how about those pesky Romans coming over with their fancy Julian calendars? Do they have much to do in Norfolk?
Yeah, there was quite a presence which began after Julius Caesar arrived in 55 BC, so actually prior to the Julian calendar.
Yes.
Things were actually pretty chilled in Norfolk, as the local tribe, the Iceni, cooperated with the Romans for nearly a century.
Turncoats.
They even kept their own king, Prasutagus, who was a client king, kind of working for the Romans, and various forts and roads were constructed around Norfolk to serve the Roman army. But when England was fully properly invaded in 43 AD, the Romans encountered a tiny problem.
I bet they did. I bet they encountered lots and lots of problems, some of them holding flint axes.
Well, yes. You see, when Prasutagus, the client king, died, the Romans told his widow that she wasn't allowed to succeed him as client king, which didn't find favour with Mrs. Prasutagus, also known as Boudicca.
Yes, yes. That's where that whole thing kicked off. And boy, did it kick off.
And we know what happened then. Also, not a lot of it actually happened in Norfolk. Shout out to what was left of Colchester after Boudicca had finished.
Yes.
Moving into the Saxon period, Norfolk was part of the Kingdom of East Angles and gradually adopted Christianity. Norfolk was the northern half of the kingdom, but honestly, it had a very similar history to that of Suffolk at the time because it was all part of one kingdom.
And we know quite low population levels compared to some parts of the country, not necessarily phenomenally wealthy at this point in time, but obviously shipping wealth eventually did see it kind of boom into the medieval era, but we're nowhere near that.
Yeah, we've got quite a well-documented line of Anglo-Saxon kings in East Anglia in that period, from the very famous Radwald, who's obviously got that ship burial at Sutton Hoo, to Anna of East Anglia, and the Wolfings tribe, which I always think is a hilarious name, but it comes from wolflings.
It does. It's so cool. It's so interesting. But then, of course, eventually, sooner or later, Billy the Conks was going to come across and he did. We know. What did he do to Norfolk?
Well, he and his pals destroyed quite a lot of Saxon Norwich, but the city was then turned into an international port with a stone Motte and Bailey castle and a magnificent cathedral complex.
I mean, it's worth saying, like, Norwich is an incredibly beautiful and interesting place. So many churches in Norwich and so much evidence of life from the medieval era onwards, isn't it?
Absolutely. Medieval Norwich would have been a pretty amazing city, I think, like bustling and cosmopolitan. But it does have a very tragic stain on its past. In the 12th century, Norwich was home to a thriving Jewish community with its own synagogue within the city, until the Jews were accused of murdering a Christian child in 1144.
Yeah, I mean, there are actually memorials to this all throughout Norwich, if you go and walk around and kind of look at the history of the place. It's something that the city has been respectful about subsequently.
Yes, and you get these stories popping up in various places in England. There's one in Lincoln as well, for example, with the little Saint Hugh. But obviously very damaging. It's the blood libel, as it's become known now, was this incredibly destructive accusation, which had a huge effect on Jewish people in Britain at the time. I mean, it's not that long after that they're actually banished from the country completely with the Edict of Expulsion in 1290.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about the Edict of Expulsion before, a very sad chapter in history. And there were those main five Jewish communities in England, and one of them was based at Norwich. And we went to try and find the spot where the child's body had been. And unfortunately, it's now in the middle of a shopping mall. And although there's a tiny little thing marking that it's the spot, there's no way that you can really recognise it. It's just kind of people walking by, going about their daily businesses with no idea.
Yeah, it's been very developed now. Norfolk seems to have historically been a place of tensions, actually. There was a riot in 1272 after a dispute between the citizens of Norwich and the cathedral priory, which resulted in the murder of 13 priors and the destruction of St. Ethelbert's Church.
Oh, that sounds quite a lot like what happened in Oxford. I know we talked about that a long, long time ago, but what did the priors do to annoy the people so much in this instance?
Clearly there was something, but lost to history.
Oh, shame.
Norfolk was largely in support of Parliament during the Civil War, but the tensions continued, especially in King's Lynn, funnily enough, from the name, which was a hotbed of secret, or perhaps not so secret, royalists.
I like the idea that they're all sneaking around, clearly dressed like royalists, going, shh. Secret.
Well, it didn't do them much good because they eventually decided to dispense with secrets and openly declare support for the king. And then they were bombarded horribly by the parliamentarian forces.
Yeah, see, I've never been to King's Lynn. I know absolutely nothing about it, but you've been there, haven't you?
I have, and there is a very interesting museum there in the former town hall, which tells you all about the siege and lots of other interesting things too. Now, I probably have time for one more piece of history, I think. Although Norfolk is interesting beyond the Civil War. I know we normally stop at the Civil War, but it is interesting beyond. But I'm going to make myself stop because of all of that juicy, juicy folklore.
Okay.
But the important historical event I'm talking about rejoices in the questionable name of the Great Blow.
Sorry? What? The Great Blow?
This was probably not what any of you were thinking.
No, probably not.
Essentially, there was another riot in Norwich in 1648 when citizens attacked the homes of prominent Puritans to protest the banning of public holidays like May Day and Christmas.
Yeah, see, that is not what I thought. I thought this might have been something a little bit naughty on the one hand. I also thought it could have been
some storm.
Yeah, or some kind of flatulence was what I was thinking. When you started with, there was a huge riot, started after Bernard the Wise let one rip. And all of a sudden, everyone was so disgusted that it started a huge fight that lasted for 6 weeks. You know, that would have been the Great Blow.
That would have been even greater.
Yes.
This particular blow, the not-so-great blow, perhaps.
Yes.
And during this riot, the protesters took possession of an armoury on Bethel Street and accidentally, don't know how, set off the barrels of gunpowder stored there, resulting in this huge destructive explosion, which came to be known as the Great Blow.
Yeah.
Did stop the rioting, however, so...
But it was heard for miles and miles and miles. Like, it was a huge amount of gunpowder.
Yeah, it destroyed a lot of things, and a lot of people were killed.
Yeah, magnificent. Well, yeah, so we had this excellent trip to Norwich last year. There's an incredible number of churches. Something like 50 churches in the Middle Ages in that city alone?
Yeah, and there are 73 active churches there now, as well as more redundant churches and churches that have been repurposed as other things.
Yeah, some of them become like restaurants or banks or whatever. Incredible.
We didn't manage to see them all. I mean, we couldn't have in just an afternoon.
No.
But it's a personal regret of mine that we didn't have time to seek out the Chapel of Julian of Norwich, one for the next visit perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, we were both pretty sad about that. For those of you who haven't heard of her, Julian of Norwich was an anchoress who wrote extensively on her Christian visions in the late 14th and early 15th centuries. Being an anchoress, if you're unfamiliar with the idea, it meant you essentially lived in seclusion in a tiny cell, usually attached to a church, and devoted your entire life to prayer and then providing advice to people who could come up and speak to you through a little hole in the wall. So Julian of Norwich, we know she had this very isolated life. She was really ill in that cell. Mm. And while she was ill on one of these occasions, she had these remarkable visions of the crucifixion, which some people say basically mark the first piece of literature written by a woman in the entire history of English literature.
Yeah, she's been called the earliest female English writer.
Yeah.
We've still got her mystic writings today. I mean, becoming an anchoress was a really serious decision at the time, so much so that when a woman chose to follow this path, a ceremony like a funeral where psalms for the dead were sung was held for her to formally enter her life of seclusion.
Yeah.
It was literally the end of her life in the outside world.
Which makes a certain amount of sense for Julian of Norwich, because we speculate that it seems like she had a husband and child who died, based on the things that she writes about and the way she writes about them. It's this sense in which she lost the most important things to her, and so kind of gives up life outside the church and, like you say, almost dies.
New relationship with God.
Yeah, and becomes a whole new person, really. So, as we know from our day trip to Norwich, there are loads of places of interest, some of which we've been to, including the cathedral and Norwich Castle. But what have we got outside Norwich?
Well, we have the beautiful Felbrigg Hall, which is unusual in that it's an unaltered Jacobean house.
Ooh.
No twiddly additions by those enthusiastic Victorian architects there.
That sounds great.
There's also Houghton Hall, which was built for England's first Prime Minister, Robert Walpole. Hocum Hall, a Neo-Palladian country house built for the first Earl of Leicester, and Blickling Hall, which is another splendid Jacobean residence built on the site of an earlier Tudor building.
Blimey, well, just from that, it seems as though we could easily spend a week in Norfolk just touring stately homes.
Yes, the National Trust and English Heritage maps for that part of the world are very thickly populated.
Yeah, I bet they are.
I think it's true. We could certainly spend a week. We could also visit Hapsburgh Lighthouse, which is the oldest working lighthouse in East Anglia, and a cope chest full of religious sites, not least of which is Walsingham.
Oh, Walsingham. Blimey. I've heard of it, but I didn't realise it was in Norfolk. From what I know about it, it was a hugely popular pilgrimage site, wasn't it?
Yes, it was basically a bit of a Catholic theme park, I think. It remains a major centre of pilgrimage today, and it was established after a Saxon noblewoman called Richelda de Faverges had a vision of the Virgin Mary in 1061 and was inspired to build a replica of the House of the Holy Family in Nazareth.
Whoa.
And this replica house is a shrine contained within a bigger church now. One of the relics that they have there is a phial of the Virgin Mary's milk.
The Virgin Mary's milk? I mean, that's gross. That's like properly gross.
Luckily, it's not something you can buy there as a souvenir of your trip. Although,
no.
I actually do have downstairs some holy water acquired from Walsingham.
Do you?
Yeah, I've not had cause to use it, but, you know, it's there just in case.
Well, yeah, it's in the vampire kit, isn't it?
Yeah, in case, you know, the devil's black army march on the house and we just need to slow them down for a little bit.
But don't worry, listener, all the magical defences are still up. We're fully protected.
We're fine. Black army be damned. My absolute favourite place I've visited in Norfolk, though, is Castle Acre Priory, the vast ruins of a once splendid priory in the village of Castle Acre, where there's also a castle.
Yes, sounds like it
I
must
believe,
have been.
Possibly called Castle Acre Castle, but my memory, that does not sound right, so my memory does not serve there. But the priory is an incredibly atmospheric place. And I will put a picture up on the blog so you can see it. But I had a wonderful day wandering around there.
Oh, it sounds like there's just so much to see in Norfolk. I really want to go and have a yomp about this summer. But also, Eleanor, you promised me folklore galore, so let's have at it.
My goodness, it is a treasure hoard. Norfolk is steeped in folklore, from ancient treasure to murder barons, avenging kings to highwaymen, witches, mermaids, holy wells, dragons. It has it all.
Excellent.
Fortunately for you, there's no way we'll be able to cover it all. Norfolk will probably warrant its own series.
Well, this is very good news for me next year. Second lap already sorted, already in the bag.
Now, panto season has just ended here in the UK.
Yeah.
So some of you might have had a chance to see Babes in the Wood this year. But the fairy tale that pantomime is based on actually comes from a Norfolk murder tale dating from the 1500s.
Whoa.
The story goes that the ownership of Griston Hall was left to a small boy called Thomas de Grey. However, if anything bad happened to Thomas, his uncle, Robert de Grey, would inherit the house and the land.
Yeah, those kinds of wills, I think, were very, very dangerous to make in the past because they're almost guaranteed that something bad would happen to said child.
I mean,
in this
making
case,
a will
Thomas,
like
know?
That really pushes people down the wicked uncle path, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, so poor little Thomas was, of course, brutally murdered in the woods close by. A detail which is often, I can't think why, omitted from modern pantomimes. Although I believe pre-20th century, the grisly truth was delivered in all its glory, complete with a warning to all those who take in orphans to take proper care of them.
Ah, Victorian theatre. Well, it has these kind of subtle as an air raid morality aspect to a Victorian play, isn't it?
Yes, I think there's a scene to be played for maximum pathos in which leaves fall on the body of the murdered child.
Aww. I mean, I do like the idea, though, in the middle of a modern pantomime of an uncle just slaughtering a child. And all the children in the front rows going, I came here to have sweets thrown at me. Well, the blood spatter. Just kind of
babes in the woods after Antonin Artaud. Now, you've just been delving into the doings of the devil for your most recent Folky Friday topic.
Yes.
So I thought I'd gather a couple of Norfolk devil tales for you to enjoy in the spirit of things. Although I'm not sure I can quite gather some of the artwork you managed to find.
No, I did find some pretty cool pictures of the devil doing stuff.
The devil can be summoned at All Saints Church in Swanton Morley if you run around the church at midnight and then whistle through the keyhole.
That must be quite difficult because if you've got to purse your lips and get them close enough to the keyhole that the whistle goes through, I think that has kind of practical implications that most people won't have considered.
Also, it doesn't say what you whistle. I mean, is it one shrill blast or do you have to do the whole of Oh Danny Boy?
Yes, or like, you know, I'm loving it, the McDonald's thing. Like, would that be fine? I mean, the devil would probably appreciate that. He'd then appear and go, excellent, evil, pure evil.
Perhaps even more dramatic than that is a place nearby the ruin of St. Peter and St. Paul's Church at Tunstall, which is known as the Hellhole.
Oh, I've been to some places with that appellation.
What, called the Hellhole?
Yeah.
Well, this Hellhole actually bubbles menacingly. It's a little boggy pool and it bubbles menacingly in the summer months. And the bubbles are said to come from the sinking church bells as they're being carried off to hell by the devil, who apparently snatched them when the priest and the church wardens were having an argument about who should take care of the bells.
Right.
The devil popped up and decided none of them should and took the bells away.
I've got to be honest, knowing what we know about the devil, there's no way he's going to be that interested to keep his attention on dragging bells through the earth for all this time.
No.
He would have totally given up and gone and done something else much more fun.
Well, it's said that the bells can still be heard ringing below the surface of the boggy hellhole on quiet nights as the devil's amusing himself by ringing them. So maybe he still finds time for a bit of bell ringing.
Do you know what I think he did? I think he delegated it to a lesser demon. Do you know what I mean?
You think Leonard was ringing bells?
Yeah, he got partway there and he was like, Azeroth, you're doing nothing. Come and drag these bells and ring them from time to time. The people up there need to get spooked.
And he's not told Azeroth to stand down at any point in the last four centuries.
And Azeroth also didn't bring a map. So he's sort of dragging it this way and that way through the earth, never quite actually getting to hell at some point.
That is its own kind of hell.
It is. Yeah. Well, you know, if you're going to be a demon, you've got to suck it up, haven't you?
Norfolk is actually quite well supplied in running around things to produce more or less desirable effects stories, actually.
Oh, yeah, okay.
There's a similar story about a witch who lived in East Somerton. She was buried alive in the nave of St. Mary's Church to prevent her causing mischief, but that was spectacularly unsuccessful.
Oh, she still caused mischief.
Oh, she still caused mischief because the witch had a wooden leg, you see. It's not funny, Martin. Yes, she's differently able.
No, I mean, that's great, but it's more that I know I can still do mischief with my wooden leg.
Well, she certainly did, because her wooden leg grew into a huge oak tree, which burst through the earth and destroyed the entire church.
What, an entire church?
Yes. The oak tree can still be seen today. It's called the Witch's Leg, and it's a quite astonishingly atmospheric place, actually. And the legend says that if you walk around the tree, or the leg, three times and call her name, the witch's spirit will be released.
I mean, somebody's got to have done that by now.
Well, you say that, but I'm not so sure because the site is also, to all reports, guarded by ghostly monks who prevent anybody walking around the witch's leg.
Well, if you're going to put things in place to make sure that this witch doesn't get loose, because imagine, that's just what she's done with a single leg. Like,
yeah, exactly.
What could she do if she was free, completely free? She sounds amazing.
Yeah, she does. But those pesky ghostly monks are preventing her from running amok.
So I guess you've got a problem there, haven't you? You're kind of in a double bind, because if you somehow manage to dispel the ghosts of the monks, you also might dispel the ghost of the witch that's underground. And maybe they're stuck and locked in a kind of situation where if anyone's exercised, we're all getting exercised, you know? It's like a death pact for the dead.
Oh, a double death pact.
A double death pact.
I like it. If you run round the churchyard of St. George's in Great Yarmouth, however, you can have a bit of a brush with history.
Yeah.
If you run around three times without stopping and then yell, "Bloody Queen Mary!" at the top of your voice, the face of Mary the First will purportedly appear at the nearest church window.
Wow, like a television set.
Yes. If you've tried this and it's worked, please get in touch, because I would love to have a chat with Mary Tudor.
Yes. Eleanor has Mary the First on her list of fantasy dinner guest. Like, she genuinely is really interested. Like, you're considering writing a play about Mary the First.
I am. I'd really love a new biography of Mary the First, or a high budget biopic, or maybe, as you say, I'll just write a play. I think she gets a bad rap, and I would like to see her rehabilitated.
Yeah, I'll tell you one very interesting fact about Mary the First, because everybody is full of hate for her because she was a Catholic and whatever. But Henry VIII introduced the Buggery Act, we know, which is the first occasion in which homosexuality became illegal in England. When Mary I came into power after her brother Edward, she repealed it. So she repealed the Buggery Act, right? It didn't exist. And then when Elizabeth I came back into power, she reintroduced it.
So Mary I is actually a little-known queer icon.
Exactly, a queer hero, you might say.
Perfect. That's really filled my heart with warmth.
Well,
thank
good.
You.
No problem.
Now, when I found the next tale, I thought we might be seeing a reappearance of our old friend, the Dun Cow.
Oh, please, please.
Because we have a cow.
Yes.
But it's a fairy cow hailing from South Lopham.
I mean, that's
and
close,
it seems a bit more benevolent than the Dun Cow. It's one of the only fairies in Norfolk, actually. There are very few fairy stories from Norfolk, and this is one of them, this cow.
This is so interesting, because the more we've learned about these counties, the more it has seemed that there are fewer fairy legends in the east of England and many, many, many more in the west.
Yes, I wonder why that is. Do you think there's sort of some invisible fairy apartheid running down the middle of England?
I mean, that's possibly true. But I also think it may have something to do with trade coming up from Brittany on the west coast and then trade coming from Scandinavia on the east.
Mm.
And I'm not sure that in Scandinavian folklore there's tons and tons and tons of fairies as we understand them, if you see what I'm saying.
No, that could be a really valid theory.
Theory developing.
Yes, developing.
Research topic.
No fairies in Doggerland.
No.
Luckily, there is a fairy cow in South Lopham, which appears in times of hardship to the village to freely give milk to people in need.
Well, this sounds just like the Dun Cow.
It doesn't go wrong like the Dun Cow, though. This is just a nice fairy cow that does that.
Well, that's good.
And when the villagers are in a better position and they can support themselves again, the cow is said to stamp down hard on a stone, burning the imprint of her hoof into it, and then vanish.
Wow.
And you can actually see the stone in South Lopham today. It is called the Oxford Stone, and it's on Brickkiln Lane. But no one's seen the cow in recent times.
Well, that's good. Let's hope that, you know, this current cost of living crisis doesn't require this cow to reappear. But also, it's interesting that every time the cow comes, it does the stamp. It's almost like it's building up Costa stamps, and eventually it's going to get a free something. Like, in time gone by, somebody promised it if it came and fed everyone six times or whatever. I think that could be the problem yet to happen with this Dun Cow. Do you know what I mean?
I like to think that the cow's become confused since people started having milk alternatives.
Yeah.
Going, oh, I want to provide for the village, but, you know, them at number 43, they have oat milk.
Yeah.
And he likes soy, and, oh, I just don't know what to do anymore.
No, okay? she needs a team, doesn't she?
She does.
Different kinds of cow, like a cow that's made of almonds.
The almond calf.
The almond calf, yes.
Love that.
Now, you've mentioned these guardian ghostly monks, but how does Norfolk do for ghosts in general?
Pretty good. There is an absolutely chilling ghost story hailing from Thetford, where the ghost of a small boy riding a headless wooden rocking horse has been sighted on the nuns' bridges.
Oh my God.
Riding this rocking horse fiercely and kind of whipping it to a frenzy.
Oh gosh, don't like that.
Apparently, it's the ghost of George, Lord Dacre, And this is a story rather similar to the Babes in the Wood tale, I'm afraid.
Well, it seems like they like killing children in Norfolk.
Well, this little boy was killed when his uncle, Sir Richard, pulled out the pin which joined the rocking horse's front hooves to the rocker.
Ooh.
And so the next time the boy was riding the rocking horse, it broke apart, dashing out little Lord George's brains, and his ghost wouldn't rest, riding about on his rocking horse and shouting all over the bridge.
I mean, this is giving me a kind of sense whereby the people of Norfolk need to watch out for their uncles.
Yes.
If you're from Norfolk and have an uncle, you just keep
just keep an eye.
Yeah.
Just keep an eye.
And has this ghost been seen recently?
No, he was laid to rest by a later vicar of Thetford who threw some new candles into the river below the bridge and told the ghost it couldn't return until the candles had been completely burned up. Needless to say, the little boy was sufficiently confused by this not to trouble the people of Thetford again.
I mean, I'm quite confused by that. Let me just get that right. He threw candles into the river.
Not lit.
Not lit, and said that until those candles have burned down, you're not allowed to do this anymore.
But exactly.
Because they're underwater.
Because they're wet and not lit. They're never going to burn down.
Cracky. I feel like that priest made things much more complicated than they needed to be.
But what I like about it is that the ghost just accepted that.
Yeah.
These problems are strangely easy to solve, aren't they?
That's true, yeah.
I just went, okay, well, seems fair. I won't ride my wooden headless rocking horse up the bridge anymore. I'll just wait for the candles.
Well, at least things work that way in folktales.
Yes.
You know, it's good that they do in folktales.
We also have, in no particular order, the Shrieking Pits of West Runton and the Groaning Well of Hapsborough.
What? They've got some very noisy holes in Norfolk, don't they?
Yes. Yes.
Lots of great blows all over the place.
Well, these pits are said to be haunted by the distraught ghost of a woman in a white dress
right.
who runs between the pits, shrieking and looking into the holes for something which she can never find.
Oh.
Yeah, it's quite sad, actually.
It is.
But the Groaning Well of Hapsborough is more like a ghost detective story.
Ooh.
The story goes that the well in Hapsborough made a dreadful groaning sound. And when it did, a ghoulish apparition of a man with a half-severed head lolling backwards on his neck, dressed as a sailor with a long plait of hair down his back, appeared and kind of lurched down the street.
Goodness.
But one night, two men followed this ghost as it lurched, and it led them to the Groaning Well, where it vanished. The next day, the men decided they should probably investigate the well, so they lowered somebody down on a rope and had a little feel around until one of them grabbed hold of something which felt like a slippery rope.
No.
And it turned out to be this long pigtail of tarred hair that had been in the sailor. And they found a decomposing body with its head half hanging off at the other end of the pigtail.
Down in a well?
Down in a well.
So everyone had been drinking dead man water?
Yep.
Oh.
Nobody knows for how long. Absolutely revolting.
Yeah, that's gross.
Anyway, they gave it a Christian burial and the well stopped groaning when an iron pump was fixed over the top.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think everybody should make sure that they can't get corpses down into their local wells, first off.
And apparently everyone is scared to remove the iron pump because they're worried that the groaning will begin again.
Yeah, understandably so.
Even though the sailor's been buried.
Yeah, there is an upside to that because you kind of just get sailor soup, wouldn't you?
Oh, don't.
Just sort of like slightly heat it from below.
Oh, come on.
Delicious.
Fishy.
Still, that is all quite unpleasant, that story, Eleanor. Don't like it.
Well, this one's much nicer. You'll like this one.
Okay.
Another very famous figure in Norfolk folklore is the Swaffham peddler, John Chapman, whose story of following his dreams to find untold gold is, well, an inspiration to us all, really. Basically, John Chapman was a peddler, bit down on his luck, and his image can actually be seen in the medieval wood carvings in Swaffham Church with his peddler's pack on his back.
He must have done something quite remarkable because to be carved into, you know, anything really when you're a peddler.
Yes, well, he was very poor and he only just scraped enough of a living together to build a miserable hut, which he sheltered in. And one night he was asleep in his miserable hut and he had a dream which told him quite clearly to go to London Bridge.
Right, okay.
And he took stock by this. I think the dream happened once or twice more, but eventually he popped his pack on his back and journeyed down the Pedder's Way onto Icknield Way and the Great North Road and into London.
Yeah.
But once he'd reached London Bridge, he could not figure out why his dream was telling him to come there at all. So he was wandered up and down London Bridge, getting crosser and crosser until eventually he was exhausted and lay down to sleep.
What, on London Bridge?
Under it.
Under London Bridge? I mean, there's a big old river there.
On the bank.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I was going to say, you're going to be going to sleep in the river then. Well, you're going to end up like that sailor, aren't
you? Well, absolutely. Yeah. The next day he went back up to London Bridge and had another little look around. And a shopkeeper came out of the shop and asked him if he was all right, because he'd watched him wandering up and down the previous day and thought he might be ill.
Yeah.
And John Chapman told him about the strange dream that he'd had. But the shopkeeper just laughed and said you shouldn't listen to dreams, because just the previous night he'd had a dream where he'd been in a little place called Swaffham and dug up an amazing store of gold underneath a hut, which sounded very like John Chapman's hut.
No!
But he wasn't going to go racing across half of England to find it. John Chapman, however, could not be seen for dust, because he was on the way back to Norfolk to make his way home as fast as possible and start digging under his hut, whereupon he found loads of gold.
Awesome.
And soon became a wealthy merchant, paying for shops and houses in Swaffham and even funding the rebuilding of Swaffham Church, which is why he's honoured today, carved on a pew and also on the village sign.
Suck it, shopkeeper. Follow your dreams, everyone. Follow your dreams. Listen to what your subconscious is saying.
Yes, I mean, the shopkeeper really was a silly one, wasn't
he? He was a sucker. Ha! In your face. Still, I enjoy a story where the moral is dreams can turn to gold.
Absolutely.
You know, I like that.
We better eat lots of cheese and see if we can't find ourselves a hoard.
I mean, it's basically what I'm up to every day.
Now, I will leave you with some helpful bits of Norfolk folk magic and medicine, just in case you're in need. Norfolk has some interesting remedies for that all too common complaint, the wart. One involves piercing a snail with a thorn and rubbing its slime on the wart, then impaling it on a white thorn bush.
Always with the impaling on bushes.
And, of course, in classic style, as the snail withers away, so does the wart.
Yeah.
But a curious special Norfolk version of this was to capture a dragonfly by its wings and hold it onto the wart until the dragonfly gradually pinched the wart off with its mandibles.
Oh, that is so gross.
This was recorded as happening as late as the start of the 20th century.
What? People kept it up. I was thinking, there's no way that people are going to be able to catch
penicillin
dragonflies.
And happened by that point, hadn't it?
That's right.
Dragonflies.
20th century, yeah, we're doing well. Like, we've got gas in some houses.
Yeah.
We've got electricity. And people are like, no, you got a wart there. You know what you need?
You need a dragonfly.
You need a dragonfly. So it seems like our ancestors were much more troubled with warts than we are these days, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, all of these cures seem to involve warts sooner or later. They were very common, but I mean, I guess diet, skincare and vaccines for the HPV virus have done wonders in the war against the wart.
True, true.
Now, we know how much everybody likes a love divination charm, but this one from Norfolk is quite unusual. I have never encountered anything similar. It involves graveyard divination and also a kind of bargain in which years of one's life are given up to gain a husband.
What, so you cash in years of your life to get a hubby?
Yeah.
And you also have to do stuff in a graveyard.
It's pretty strange.
Sounds quite dark.
Well, here's how the charm goes. It's a little spell with the instructions that you need to follow. To gain a husband, name known or unknown, make your choice on a graveyard stone. Quarter day's night if they're fair a moon, pass through the church gate right alone. Twist three crosses from graveyard bits, place them straight in your finger slits. Over the grave hold a steady hand, and learn the way the side crosses stand. One is yourself and your husband one, and the middle one need be named of none. If they both on the middle cross have crossed, his name you win, and a year you've lost. For he who lies in the namesake mould, his soul has sold, or he would have sold, and you give a year which the dead may use, your last year of earth life that you lose.
Wow, that is different. And I could say, quite a lot more intense than just eating a salty meal or looking into a mirror while brushing your hair to see your husband's face on one of those special nights of the year. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I think it's quite crazy, really. It's like, find somebody who's died who's got the name of the person you fancy and stand on their grave and see how the divination takes
with some
you.
Weird twiddly bits some, in between
yeah,
your fingers.
Yeah, I mean, what are graveyard bits? I really hope that's plants growing in the graveyard.
Yeah.
But it's not clear.
No, it could be bits of people, couldn't it?
It really could. But, of course, perhaps the most famous tale from Norfolk is that of England's most notorious dog.
Yes.
Yes, that's right. I've been saving my love of our four-legged friends up for a few weeks, haven't I? I haven't told a dog story for quite some time. I've been saving it for the tale of Black Shuck. And I'll start spinning my yarn right after this.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Times like these, the waiting's heavy. Each breath crackles with the expectation of a storm. Fraught and spawning times, like a mother dog puffed up with puppies. Something seeks someone. Someone seeks something. Something must be given, and something must be taken away. I'll tell you of a strange and terrible wonder, and I need you to believe me, although not for long. Follow me. Close your eyes and let yourself be led astray. Wander from the path. Breathe in deep. Go on. Inhale the candles. Let the scent carry you back across the centuries. Beeswax and tallow twining round the pillars. A church, a place of sanctuary in the salt marshes, the heath and pasture. Follow me to sweating, sultry August, where darkness hovers like clouds of blood-drunk flies. Darkness. So close at hand. It might be now. Some things are not so different. Famine, taxes, arguments about religion. A war going on, somewhere, though it isn't here just yet. People. People you've met before, probably. You might even have been some of them. A soldier, a dancer, an orphan, and a big black dog, of course. But we'll get to that. Everywhere like this, each comfortable community needs whatever telling of a witch conforms to fashion at the time. The poor, the old, the different. Somebody to take the blame. A vessel for the demons the righteous are too scared to claim. There are those who can fit in, and there are those who never have. On the outskirts of acceptable, an orphan lived uneasily. A true blue orphan of indeterminate age. Nobody had known her parents, but everybody had their views. Child of the foul-mouthed gravedigger long since dead, or that woman who'd been hanged for theft. But all they knew for certain was that she'd been left, abandoned at the almshouse, growing up grieving without knowing what for. Though living untethered to parents or place is an unquiet thing, she did survive. Though the village children mocked her and the cats all spat. Narrow streets make narrow minds and hearts, which offer scraps like roses. He never asked for charity, but charity's what she got. She was taken in, but it was sharp, that charity, a charity of hard hands and bitter words. They told her she was like the dog, the storm that threatened the village. For all they knew, she was the devil's puppy too. There was a legend in the village, you see. It started when the priory fell. The monks' wolfhounds, all left behind in shards of smashed stained glass and broken effigies, began to kill and eat each other. They killed and ate, until just one was left alive. A vast hound bitch the size of a donkey, accustomed to the taste of blood. In kindness, a farmer took her in, fed and tamed her, or so he thought. But soon she ran and was lost for days. The farmer gave her up for dead. When she returned at last, she was exhausted, tongue lolling, footpads torn, and belly swollen huge with pups. All right-thinking folk could see it, plain as a nail in a bronze horseshoe. It was the devil's work. Just one puppy came from the hound bitch's brood. A beast, an abnormality, a red-eyed hellion. Black Shuck, we call him. Skeff, snarly owl. He gallops in the mist along the marshes, grinning carnage with his filthy teeth. One look will kill you, or someone you love. He's the hand of night, spreading its fingers over our heads. They told her she was like Black Shuck, appeared from nowhere to cast a shadow. But still, the shadow was just a shadow. The storm had not yet broken, and all things were imbalanced. There was neither enough of one or too much of the other. To this fragile peace returned a soldier, home and yet not home. Some run towards war and others run away. For the soldier, it was both. The cause was not the reason for his going, though he believed that something would be changed. Good deeds notched gradually on his soul's shield, fighting fire with fire. He met the orphan as she carried water in the red poppy sunset of the ruined priory, as hellhound voices sounded through the forest. He asked her what it meant, the village dogs all howling in one voice. What's eating all the dogs tonight? Better to ask what the dogs are eating. Those aren't the village dogs, she told him. Black Shuck and his terrible spawn. Ghosts and demons, evil portents, omens. That's what's said anyway. That's what they believe. The soldier gave no weight to these prattling yarns. The worst stories always come from the firesides. People will say anything until they've really lived it. Then they keep quiet. If he saw something in her eyes, he could not name it. And she herself was nameless. Nobody. If he saw the traces of another life there, he could not touch them. He had believed the war so far behind him, saltwater acres rolling out between them. But standing in the ruined priory where ghosts stretch out as long as shadows, he heard the hungry hatred of the howling and wondered if he had stepped into a new one. You've almost met them all, our players, though one at least still stalks the forests between midnight and dawn. In the village there was a dancer. She ran light-footed from sorrow and swayed her hips to nudge aside all woes. The rains of melancholy sizzled when they touched her skin, and grief and regret poured from her twisting hands, libations on the earth. Her smile was a fortress against memory, her hair a net to catch bad dreams. the past she did not speak of, when something small was taken and something greater given. In the inn she met the soldier, but they could not say the words which rolled around in the silences of the past. He could not speak of the war to her, of the new scars on his body and in his eyes. He could not tell her of the things he saw. The little girl whose hair was falling out from fear, and the old man who did not understand how his hair had become white and his betters still could not agree. For the clouds of musket dust there were no words, and for the stench still fewer. Instead, he told her that he thought of her sometimes, when the mud wasn't so deep, and the cloud of hungry flies buzzing around the dead men could be mistaken for a handful of hawthorn blossom. And she couldn't hear him, seeing no good in mere thoughts. What were thoughts but smoke, easily wafted aside? Thoughts don't cook geese. Instead, she told him of the devil's hound, who all were afraid of but her, and how it came to her when she walked the marshes on a moonless night. How she'd seen Black Shuck, sitting in her way as bold as steel, with marsh light and murder in its monstrous eyes. Each tooth the memory of a scream, fur matted with a dank whiff of despair. He asked if she was frightened. The dog is death to those who see it. Why not you? Maybe it wanted to do some good, she said. The strange part, it ran from her a little way, then turned and bounded back again, 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 as though it wanted her to follow it. So she did, and she'd swear on any book you like that old Shuck took her safe back through the marsh, the dog running beside the woman until the crossroads, where it vanished. Talk lessened after that, and things unspoken were lost in hazel eyes and grazing thighs, in touches as soft as the dust from ruined abbeys. Are you still with me? Follow me into the church. It's just a short step away. The creaking door gives way to evensong. The air hanging humid with the smell of sweat and hay fresh from the field. Candles make the place a smoky beehive. Like an itch between the shoulder blades, the congregation shift, awkward, unable to reach, to scratch. A lazy rivulet of perspiration on the rector's forehead, and the angels on the roof obscured by haze. Blessed are they that do his commandments. Their right may be in the tree of life. They may enter in through the gates into the city, for without shall be dogs, and enchanters, and murderers, and whosoever loveth or maketh lies. The faces of the figures carved on bench ends seem to twist, their oaken features smirking, while the sky frowned black displeasure, and with a sudden hammering the rain escaped the clouds. Blessed are they that do his commandments. A clap of thunder split apart the blackness. Their right may be in the tree of life. All at once, a pounding on the church door, once, twice, thrice it struck the wood. They may enter in through the gates into the city, for without shall be dogs. The door burst open. Black Shuck was everywhere, his eyes as bright as braziers, his tongue a flaming ribbon, his growl a thundercrack. Each barrage splintered the floor tiles. Where he leapt, he devastated. Those he touched, he killed. His howl pierced the heavens, calling the lightning to lash down, calling hell to open and unleash its very worst. A whip-fast bolt of lightning hissed from sky to earth, cleaving the tower and rending the steeple. It sent the bells into furious chiming pieces and smashed the spire down. As fast as worry, Shuck had gone. The wrecked church tower, his calling card, and the smoking claw marks in the door, and all the people he had touched stark dead. After, though, the storm had broken, the darkness had not melted away. Instead, the sky was bruised, like sleepless shadows behind the lashes of the trees. Every tear was like a stone, and the stones dropped on the village, shoring it up, blocking the windows, damming the streams. It's easy to become a stone, you see. Hard to be a fox, slipping slyly from a snare. Hard to be a starling, fluttering fast for freedom. But easy to be a stone, heavy, stubborn, cruel. The soldier and the dancer's silences burst like swelling warts in an eruption of anger and accusation. Why did they do it? They could full well see the cuts they made, yet still persisted. Where they could have been together, they pushed at each other, until they were as alone as they had ever been. And scenes of a similar nature played all through the village, in a non-stop run without an interval. Kindness was left out in the cold and given a few kicks just for good measure. Black Shuck had claimed the village, captured, chewed and slurped it, making it his own. Nobody saw what the dog had done, or noticed what they'd become. Frowns were knitted into every shawl, and spite baked into puddings. But somebody had seen. Somebody knew. It takes a homeless dog, sometimes, to recognize another. To see the anger, fear, and pain which makes us cast our longest shadow. As the raven who carefully gathers twigs to build a nest and shroud her fragile eggs in lamb's wool safety, the orphan went from door to door to ask for help against Black Shuck. As the raven who can find nothing for her fledglings to eat battles helplessly with the winter blizzard and gets no reply to her crying, she too knew there was no answer. Everywhere she found closed doors, closed faces, unfeeling words. "We must do something," she said. "If we don't do something, together, all of us together, Black Shuck will destroy our village. Like a serpent, he'll tighten his coils around us, panting, salivating, until we've coffined ourselves in darkness and served ourselves up steaming. We must do something." But her words were met with cruelty. "None of us ever wanted you, stray dog child. Go back to the gutter and sing your mad songs there. You were in the church that day. Why didn't Black Shuck murder you?" As the raven who can fly no further, whose wings are wet and heavy with the snow, she could scarcely drag herself along. She could not feel her heart. But the raven did not die, and the orphan did not die. She did not know how to do it, but she knew what must be done. Something seeks someone, so someone must seek something. Something had to be given, and something taken away. Determination gave her the strength to straighten her shoulders, to lift her face and let the light stroke it for the first time. To hear above the beat of wings, as though someone passing in flight had stopped to listen. She went beyond the village gates. She crossed over the river. She went through the salt marshes and deep into the forest. She walked into the dark. Every sound was a claw being sharpened to rip and tear. Every movement was a beast limbering up to pounce. Every rustle was a promise. "You'll be dead meat." Her hopelessness was greater than her fear. She knew that people like her don't fight great battles. People like her don't ever win. And in the dark, he sniffed at her defeated loneliness as though it was the sweetest perfume. With savage puffs of stinking breath and eyes like clots of blood, Black Shuck stalked through the forest. Each footfall thundered. His swiping tail scorched the tree bark where it brushed, his fur writhing like black maggots, his teeth as long as grudges. Each step he took towards her swelled his power. The Shuck was one huge gaping maw, ready to devour, to suck all joy down to the marrow and leave only emptiness behind. She flung a hand out, and in her open palm was all her isolation, all her yearning and her dreams. This orphan girl, her history so unknown that even the lines in her palms were blank, had quite by accident shone a light that a passing angel could take a shine to. A celestial light in an unwashed hand which shuddered through the village. It made its way to the inn in its air of desperate merriment, where people put themselves through the motions, forcing themselves to boisterous mirth. In this furious whirlwind of biting words, of spilt ale and broken friendships, the soldier and the dancer refused to see each other. His hands shook as he spiced his draught with self-pity. He could not look at her, and yet he could not leave the inn. Her hands were fists. Her nails dug in as she turned and turned. She could not look at him. Yet every second she knew he was there. The thunder rumbled once. Then the clouds parted. The light was without and within, pouring through the cracks in the floor and ceiling and through the cracks in hearts. The most curious thing, which nobody ever understood afterwards, was where the feathers came from. A soft, white snowfall in the August heat. Was it a flock of fleeing heron, startled, shedding as they soared away? Most people, when they tell the tale now, agree that an angel must have passed. Something had been given. Now something could be taken away. While the inn was in the sudden clutches of joy and a few stray feathers still drifted from the ceiling, a rumour chanced to join the crowd of an orphan girl and how she'd left the village, crossed the marshes and gone to meet Black Shuck. Slowly it dawned on the villagers what had been given and what might have been taken away, and that if there was a chance to save her, they had to take it now. A dancer who had held in all her woe let it go, as she laughed and sobbed at once. And a soldier who had never known his father allowed himself to imagine what it was to be a father, and what it was to lose a daughter in the moment he had found her, as he raced towards the forest of Black Shuck. Stories can change, you know. We're afraid of dying, but death is so small. It happens once. It's a tiny mouse squeak when the hawk dives down and gone. Life is long and huge and sprawling, beginning after beginning and a great big middle. The orphan touched the black dog's snout. "I was a mouse," she said. "A mouse, scared of all the hawks which might be waiting. Now I can be brave, uncurl my shoulders, look the whole world in the eyes. You don't have to run on fury either. Once you walked a woman safely home. Even the biggest dogs can stop to chase the butterflies." And when the soldier found her, the dog was calm and the sky was clear. She didn't know yet why she felt like a memory to him, but she would know. The nameless can be named. Stories can change. In the village, great plans were made. the church rebuilt, the bells gilded anew, sea heather and dog roses brought inside to garland the angel roof. Other smaller things were patched as well, carefully polished and mended, so they were better than before they broke. Old rivalries, bitter words and jealousies all were put aside. And on the road with rowan trees, out of the forest and by the marshes, a soldier and an orphan went on foot. The night was past, and the dawn had nicked her finger, seeping blood into the edges of the horizon. Among the rowan trees, a small bird was pouring her heart out, singing of a life both cruel and beautiful. As she sang, the storm clouds sighed and slunk away, and the rain softly spanned the sky into dreamy silk. With it fell kindness, drop by drop, a heartfelt word, bread shared, a goose bought with a soldier's last penny. Night by night, the shadow of Black Shuck was shrinking. The stories changed. As the rain fell, a soldier and an orphan went back to where a dancer was waiting to forget and to remember what it was to kiss with a mouthful of blackberries and how to find the blue feather of love in the magpie's black and white. As the rain fell, a dog was playing, bounding and stalking in the priory ruins, hunting a butterfly and letting it fly free. All fears can be overwhelmed with words. All flowers grow in dirty, fertile mud. And all homeless dogs have hope.
Oh my goodness, Helena, you're making me cry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's a very, very beautiful story. Thank you so much. And I've got to ask, you know, because your story, your approach to it is quite abstract, it's quite dreamlike, it's very poetic and lyrical. But what are the facts? What are the basic facts of the Black Shuck myth?
I mean, they're fairly short, yeah. The basic facts. Basically, the story that I kind of based my story on is a piece of writing called A Strange and Terrible Wonder by a chap called the Reverend Abraham Fleming,
yes.
Who wrote about this occurrence of Black Shuck attacking two churches in East Anglia, in Holy Trinity in Blythburgh and St. Mary's in Bungay. And legend slightly vary, but essentially the dog smashed in the middle of a church service, in the case of the Blythburgh church, leaving his claw marks on the door.
Yes.
And ripped down the tower, killed a few people. Basically, if he touches you, you die instantly. And then he ran away.
Yeah, and that's kind of all you get.
Yeah, and Bungay and Blythburgh are not that close to each other, but the dog apparently covered the distance very quickly.
Yeah, very quickly, on the same day.
With big black legs.
Kind of remarkable tale. Yeah. And one that has echoed through English folklore ever since. I mean, over a millennia, really.
Yeah, well, this the occurrence, the Strange and Terrible Wonder, was supposed to have happened in the 1580s.
Oh, okay, broadly. So not a millennia, so
not
over 500
no,
years.
But there had been previous black dogs
of course.
Before this specific incident.
And if you're interested in black dogs generally, then the lovely friend of ours who runs the folklore podcast, Mark Norman, has written a book all about the history of black dogs in folklore. He covers the whole of England, talking about these representations of black dogs. Now, for you, what did Shuck represent?
To me, the dog is this kind of suspicion and fear within a community. And I think it's also like the idea of the black dog as depression.
Yes.
It's like kind of becoming the worst versions of ourselves, being mean, lashing out, being full of self-hatred.
And I think when we think about ourselves as animals, we know that if we are maligned and left outside of things and seen as cursed or evil or unlikable as an other,
yes,
then it's very likely to breed behaviour and emotions and attitudes that aren't necessarily going to be good for anyone involved.
No, and you might just tear a church down.
No. So I think it, in your story, it's very interesting that you pick these three archetypes, the orphan, the soldier, and the dancer, and then weave a tale together whereby everybody manages to find love at the end, which is very, very beautiful, very, very pretty. I mean, what inspired you to frame the story in that way? Because this is the basic story of your play, Black Shuck, which has been running up and down the country for what?
And it's big black legs.
5 years, yeah. 6 years? Yeah.
What inspired me? I wanted to use, none of these people have names, obviously. I wanted to use these kind of archetypes of people that we have probably all seen aspects of ourselves in. I always I like to write about a war just off stage. I think perhaps because in our lifetimes as people living in England, there's always been a war just off stage.
Yeah,
there in the last 30 years.
Yeah, certainly for us.
And it always feels like it's not here yet, but it could be.
Definitely.
And I wanted that idea that there was this character who's seen some horrible things in a war and has come back to try and figure out how to be normal in a village community and can't really do it. And then he's got this past with this woman and they were never able to be fully honest with each other and end up still not being fully honest with each other. And they've had this child, which they've had to abandon. And basically, better communication all round required. Maybe the black dog is just failure to communicate.
Well, I also think there's something about those things that you don't want to talk about, those things that you don't want to acknowledge, and how they can grow and grow to become something
much bigger.
Much bigger,
yes,
and monumental.
If you keep not talking about it, then it's going to come in and tear your church tower down.
It is, metaphorically speaking, or literally, in case of the strange and terrible wonder.
The church tower was torn down, but whether it was the doings of a great big storm or a black dog.
It was a black dog. It was obviously a black dog.
Yes, absolutely.
Everyone knows that it was Black Shuck. Well, thank you so much, Eleanor. Absolutely wonderful story. And you squeezed some more tears out of me, damn it. Are you ready to talk correspondence?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Well, first off, thank you to everybody who's commenting on episodes on Spotify. I finally figured out how to open comments for all past episodes. Look at me figuring out technologies.
I have no idea how any of it works, and I'm absolutely fine with that.
Yeah, you don't worry about it. I'm on it. And in terms of particular people to thank, Logan Grimmer, 1979, said of last week's Gilles de Rais bonus episode, as usual, absolutely brilliant. Keep providing us with more history told in your unique and captivating manner.
Oh, thank you, Logan Grimmer, and we will do our best.
We also had lovely comments from Lissa and another person whose name just appeared as a full stop.
Mysterious.
Yeah, I know. But they both said they very much enjoyed your Staffordshire episode, not least the scary story you told, and that it had a happy ending.
Oh, I'm so glad. It was nice to be able to give a positive conclusion to a quite dark reality. Mm. And I always find it interesting that people want happy endings to our stories.
Yeah, I'm not always great at happy endings or ending on a positive. So for series 4, I'm going to see about writing more scary stories with happy endings. Not sure how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to try.
Dig deep, Martin.
I will. And thank you to Shauna, also on Spotify, who wrote about your basket and trug making dying arts episode. As with all the dying arts episodes, basket and trug making turned out to be fascinating. Thanks to Eleanor and Martin. Research and presentation. I need more baskets in my life.
We all need more baskets, Shauna. You can't have too many.
I'm not 100% that's true.
Oh, it is. It's like cushions. You can never have too many cushions. Although I will concede that sometimes they're not in the right places. Right number of cushions, wrong places.
Well, moving swiftly on, we also had not just one, but two new reviews this week.
Oh, yay! Well, hopefully they were nice ones.
They were. Both lovely ones. Both also on iTunes. The first came from Rufy Ma, who writes, a brilliant mix of myth, magic, and original storytelling. Each episode is based around a different county and is filled with local folklore, history, and myths, and finishes with a story written by one of the hosts. Martin and Eleanor are enthusiastic and engaging, and their sense of humour helps to make this a joy to listen to.
That's so nice, Rufy Ma. We are very glad you share our sense of humour.
Yep.
And I do like to be thought of as an enthusiastic and engaging, don't you?
Yeah, of course. It's a good thing to be, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it's good to like things and be enthusiastic about them.
Yeah, definitely. The other review came from Bartholomew Weaver, also on iTunes, who writes, "Brilliant podcast. I only discovered Three Ravens a couple of weeks ago and have already listened my way to halfway through series two."
Well done, Bartholomew. That is very impressive binging. Bravo. I wish I was that good at listening to podcasts.
Oh, thank you so much. He continues, "It's such an easy listen. Gobbets of interesting folklore delivered by hosts who sound as if they're having a really good time. The stories that end each county episode are well written and brilliantly performed. Thank you, Eleanor and Martin."
Oh, well, thank you, Bartholomew. Mm-hmm. We're both so glad you're enjoying it all. And welcome to the Conspiracy of Ravens.
Yes, yes. Gronk, gronk.
If you, dear listener, have not yet had the chance to write us a review, please do hop onto iTunes or Apple Podcasts and write us one. We'd be very grateful, and we will absolutely read your review out on the next episode.
We certainly will, and each one really does help other people to find the podcast. And it bears repeating that Three Ravens has only grown to become what it is because of our listeners. We really don't have the resources to market the podcast in traditional ways, so the whole thing relies on word of mouth. The more people you can tell about it, the better, really.
And likewise, wherever you listen to us, do drop us some stars, give us a thumbs up, share us on social media by letter, postcard, or carrier pigeon.
Yes, stand on a building with a megaphone, maybe? Just like badger people. "Hey there, stranger. Do you like folklore? How about a creepy bedtime story? Well, let me tell you about the Three Ravens podcast."
I wonder if that would work or if people would run away screaming.
Well, if enough people approached you with glittering eyes and silver tongues nagging you to listen to the podcast, eventually you are going to give it a listen, aren't you?
Well, probably. Or run away screaming.
Well, yeah, either way is fine, I suppose. Also, as we're coming to the end of the series, it's worth saying we're looking at trying to organise live shows for the not too distant future.
Yes, Three Ravens Live.
We've already been invited to do a couple of quite big events locally. We're going to be at Chichester Festival and Battle Festival in the summer.
Super exciting. And as soon as tickets are on sale, we'll share details on social media and so on.
But also, thank you to Gemma, who contacted us about an event she thought might fit with Three Ravens up in Yorkshire. We've emailed the event organisers about it, and, you know, we're wondering, dear listener, is there a folky weird event or venue near you where you think Three Ravens Live might work?
Yes, please. If you know people running local festivals or events, or who just run cool venues around the country, we would absolutely love it if you could put us in touch. Contact us via social media or email threeravenspodcast@gmail.com. We are super keen to get out into the world and meet listeners and tell stories in rooms full of people.
Yes, not just here. Well, there's only the two of us. We do also have some Rust and Stardust shows coming up in the summer to talk about as well.
Yes, as we mentioned, we'll be in Norfolk for my show Black Shuck, coincidentally enough, at Black Shuck Festival in Norfolk this year. Extremely excited about that. Actually, we have got two shows in that festival. The Wild Man of Orford will also be making an appearance.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. Come to Black Shuck Fest 2024, everyone. It's going to be awesome.
But in general, do get in touch with us if you think Three Ravens will be a fit for something local to you. Mm. And if we can, we'll bring Ben along as well and sing some songs live. It'll be magical.
It really will. So yes, email threeravenspodcast@gmail.com and hook us up. Friends of a feather, etc., etc.
And in terms of emails this week, thank you to everyone for that last flurry of folky flash fiction entries. Much appreciated. But if you have stories or folklore from your area, ghost stories, strange local beasties or fascinating ruins, do email us about them.
Yes.
We'll be releasing a new listener episode to help fill the gap before Series 4 begins, and we're always looking for more local knowledge.
We certainly are. Please do send things through, along with feedback. We're always happy to hear from people, not least on social media, where we've had some lovely chats on Facebook with Simon, for example, about last week's Leap Day special, Sophie, Ash, Abby, and lots of people, actually, about Herne the Hunter. And special thank you to Cress Laurie on Instagram, who has crowned me King of Puns.
Oh no, Cress Laurie, what have you done? Don't encourage
what
him.
What are you saying? Encourage me. I love to pun. Punning is my favourite. I think I should have a special pun crown, a glinting diadem.
No, I am shutting this down right now. Aww. Who were our likers, commenters and super sharers this week?
Well, lots of lovely people. And thank you to those of you who've been the bedrock of the Three Ravens social media community during our first lap around the country. You know who you are. And seriously, my goodness, we wouldn't be where we are without you. You guys are the best.
Likewise, our hardcore Patreon crew. You guys are the motor that keeps this clown car on the road, honestly.
As for this week specifically, though, big pinion claps go to Paul, Andrew, Sabrina, Reese and Molly on Facebook, Stephanie, Adam Philip Photography, Rach F. King, Lily Sophia and Latore de Bollingen on Instagram, and Debbie Kuhn, Matt Ski, Lawrence Tilly, Bevan Thomas and Psyche Cinema on Twitter.
While we're on our break, we won't be quite so active on social media, but we will be posting about new episodes and other bits and bobs. You can always find us on the Three Ravens podcast group on Facebook, of course, and chat away with other lovely listeners there, and on facebook.com/Three Ravens Podcast, Instagram at Three Ravens Podcast, and on Twitter or X at Three Ravens Pod.
And the best place for properly new exclusive content is, of course, the Three Ravens Patreon at patreon.com/Three Ravens Podcast. We'll be releasing all of our episodes there ad-free as per normal during the break, plus a new Patreon exclusive episode for March and a film club episode at the end of the month all about The Devil Rides Out.
Really excited about that one.
Yeah, me too. And as we wind to a close, I just want to say thank you. Thank you so, so much for listening to Three Ravens this year. Whether you've just found us or have been listening since the beginning, this whole project, meeting you all, seeing our little podcast family and community grow from a handful to hundreds to thousands, it really has been one of the great honors of my life. And I say this as someone who's always wanted to make things that connect to lots of people and which matter to lots of people. But nothing I have ever done has reached so many human beings all across the world as Three Ravens has. Plus, to have been invited into the lives of thousands of people, into your homes, your cars, your minds, and to have shared stories and laughter and traveled all around England with you, it has meant an enormous amount. So thank you sincerely for making us part of your life and for supporting us and being so kind. And I'm so excited about where the future might lead. Who knows how big this project might get, but however big it does get, don't forget, it's happening because of you, dear listener, the Third Raven. We are one and two, but without you, we're just telling stories to ourselves.
Until next time then, while our story's gone that way, we'll go this way.
And remember, don't whistle until you're out of the woods.
Thanks and credit go to This Hollow Land by Peter Tolhurst, Shuckland by Charles Christian, and Norfolk Folk Tales by Hugh Lupton. Our theme song is the traditional folk ballad Three Ravens, performed by Eleanor Conlon and Ben Harbour. And our logo is by Ollie James Dare.
The Three Ravens podcast is a Rust and Stardust production, produced by me, Martin Vaux. Thanks for listening.
God sent every gentleman, such hounds, such hawks, and such leman, with a down, derry, 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 down, down.